Now on Bloomberg 1200.
I have traveled this country from one end to another, and I come back to Boston, Massachusetts.
The historic startup culture is astounding.
Everybody do your job.
And together we're going to make Boston even stronger.
This is the Bloomberg Bay State Business Hour with Tom Morody and Ann Mustu on Bloomberg 1200 and 94.5 FM HD2.
This is the Bloomberg Bay State Business Hour. I'm Ann Mustu here in our Bloomberg 1200 newsroom in downtown Boston with Tom Morody, my co-host. Tom, did you have a happy Thanksgiving?
Absolutely. And you?
I did. Thank you very much.
Good.
I hope our listeners did too.
Coming up on our show today, we'll talk about a new index that rates the success of novel drugs. And the Mass High Tech Council drops by to talk about a new survey that shows what CEOs like and don't like about Boston.
It's going to be a good show. So in studio with us is Charlie Stein, who is a reporter here at Bloomberg. Charlie, let's talk about the news this week that Fidelity has said Abigail Johnson will succeed her father as chairman.
It was a little surprising, but the truth is Abigail has been running the company as the CEO for the past few years. This is maybe a little more symbolic, I guess, but kind of signals the end of an era and a passing of the torch.
Yeah, and is there any significance, Charlie, about why now?
Well, he's 86 years old. Maybe he doesn't want the responsibility. You know, who knows? But I mean, I think, you know, when you're looking back on Ned Johnson, you have to say this guy's up there in the pantheon, maybe with two or three other people, like maybe Jack Bogle of Vanguard, is really the giants of the mutual fund business. He took over this company from his father. And, you know, it was, I think, a reasonably successful business, and he turned it into a giant under his tenure.
Was that just because of the focus on retirement money management?
I think that came a little bit later, and although that was certainly an important piece. But in the 70s, Fidelity was one of the real pioneers in money market funds. That's the way a lot of people who previously maybe had all their money in banks first moved to a mutual fund company. And then when the stock market took off in the 1980s, people kind of shifted over and they moved to Fidelity in part because Fidelity had a guy named Peter Lynch who was Mr. Stock Picker, you know, phenomenal record for the 13 years he ran the Magellan Fund. And it really became the place to go for people who wanted to buy mutual funds and buy mutual funds that beat the market. At least a lot of them did.
Charlie, is Lynch as important a figure in this company as Ned Johnson? Is there any comparison there?
I think they're both awfully important. The truth is Ned Johnson, like his daughter, was never a public figure. I mean, he was almost never interviewed. You never heard him give a speech or anything like that. Whereas Peter Lynch became famous. I mean, he was on commercials. He had that sort of big shock of white hair that everybody recognized. He wrote a couple of popular books. So I would say in many ways, he probably was as important.
And you still see him around town at events.
That's right. You know, he hasn't run the Magellan Fund since 1990, which is a very long time ago. But he's still, if you asked people to name a famous mutual fund manager, a lot of people would probably still name Peter Lynch.
1990 was the last year.
Do you hear anything, Charlie, through the grapevine about the management styles of either Abigail or her father?
You don't hear very much about it. You know, they just don't go public with what they do. But, you know, she's like a lot of people who've come into a family business. She ran some mutual funds. She ran different pieces of the business. You know, she's really, you know, learned Fidelity over more than 25 years. So, you know, one has to assume she has a pretty good grasp of what's going on there. The Fidelity, to be fair, is not the dominant company it once was. It's still very successful, but it, you know, it's kind of doesn't be, you know, it's not the colossus it was, say, in the 80s and 90s.
Well, and that really gets to my next question. I mean, so where is Fidelity at in the larger scheme of things? Is it, it's not the leader anymore?
No, Vanguard actually passed them in about 2010, and it's really about the difference between index funds and active management. Fidelity was always known as a place for stock pickers. People have lost faith, I think you could say, in stock picking. They've moved to index funds, which are cheaper and maybe easier to understand. Fidelity has actually sort of, rather than simply fought that off, they've joined that movement. They have a lot of index funds themselves, but they just don't attract the kind of money they once did.
And they also have exchange-traded funds, ETFs.
They do. But again, they were kind of late to that business. You know, they have a modest presence in it. And it's kind of hard to come late to some of these things that other people dominate. You know, I mean, I don't want to overstate it. They manage $2.1 trillion. It's a lot of money. But they have lost market share to Vanguard, certainly, in the last 3 or 4 years.
You know, and certainly Abigail's a lot like her father in the idea that you don't hear a lot from her at all.
It's interesting, though. I think everyone in Boston knows somebody who works or worked at Fidelity. And from what I've heard, she's very down to earth. She drove a Jeep Grand Cherokee, I remember hearing a while ago, and lives in Milton and just sounds like a normal person.
What about her team, Charlie? You know, I see this ad on TV. One of their fund managers is featured, which is kind of unusual for Fidelity to take that step.
They've done that a little bit in the last couple of years, I think, to let you know that they're still good at what they do, because they don't really have the kind of household names, you know, like a Peter Lynch. It's just not that kind of business anymore. But, you know, Fidelity's one of those places. There's a few places like it in the industry where they attract the best and the brightest. They come there young. They tend to stay there forever. You know, some of their best money managers, like Will Danoff on the Contra Fund, have been.
He's the one that does the commercial.
He does a commercial, I think, where somebody writes him a letter and says, you know, thank you for, you know, turning my money into a lot of money or something.
Yeah, you like sent that. My kid through college.
Right.
All right, Charlie, thank you so much.
Sure.
Abigail Johnson is now chairman as well as CEO. I'm Tom Maroney along with Ann Mastu. Coming up, a new index that rates the success of novel drugs. We'll also hear from the Mass High Tech Council on what CEOs like and don't like about Boston and the region. This is the Bay State Business Hour on Bloomberg 1200.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Bay State Business Hour with Tom Maroney and Ann Mastu on Bloomberg 1200 and 94.5 FM HD2.
This is the Bloomberg Bay State Business Hour. I'm Ann Mastu in our Bloomberg 1200 newsroom in downtown Boston with my co-host Tom Maroney.
Now, Ann, you spoke earlier this week to John Corcoran, founder and president of Trinity Partners in Waltham, and they've just come out with this drug index. Tell us what that's all about.
Sure. So it's a way of measuring the commercial success and therapeutic value of prescription drugs, specifically the 20 to 40 or so novel drugs that the FDA approves every year. And while, you know, trial success often translates to commercial success, there are some exceptions. And I started by asking him about that.
We felt in the marketplace that there was a need for a retrospective look at how pharmaceuticals, novel drugs, are performing in the market. This, oddly enough, had not been done in any serious way before. We do know that when a pharmaceutical is launched, that it takes a few years to understand if it's having impact. And impact can be a couple of different things. It can be commercial success. It can be therapeutic impact, how it's used. And there's also some lessons there about how R&D is done, research development intensity. We're doing it not so much just to score performance, even though it lends itself to that. We're also trying to understand what drugs perform better and why certain drugs don't perform well. And one of the lessons, both for us as consultants and for our client organizations, so that launches can be optimized. It's a very exciting space now. There's a lot of drugs coming through the approval process. So we felt that doing this on an annual basis, and we intend to, would be critical.
And is this the first time you've done it?
Yes, and this one is focused on 2013. So we're giving ourselves a couple of years to evaluate these drugs once they're launched.
So I've read through the report, but tell the listeners some of the top findings and the drug that was most successful.
Sure. One of the interesting correlations, which at one level is kind of obvious, is that drugs with the highest therapeutic value tend to perform best in the marketplace. There's a fairly strong correlation there. The one of interest, which is generally a well-known drug, is Sovaldi, which is indicated for Hep C. It's a Gilead drug. It's an oral medication. It's a curative medication, and it has, both on the therapeutic scale, performed well. It's a curative drug in a very nasty disease state in hepatitis. The commercial success has been off the chart. It's also been one of those ones that draws a lot of attention about its price. And we can talk about that if you want later. But there's also a couple of others. These are generally in the specialty category. So these are specialty pharmaceutical products that have different characteristics in the marketplace. A lot of them are showing up in the rare disease categories, in orphan drugs. A lot of them are developed by Massachusetts companies, which is exciting for us as residents and taxpayers.
Yeah. What's your background, John? Did you work in a biotech or pharma company before going to Trinity?
No, I did not. I started Trinity 20 years ago, actually. We just went by our 20th anniversary in July.
Congratulations.
As quick background, we're based, as you mentioned, in Waltham. We have 130 consultants now in New York, San Francisco, and a new office in Princeton. We're organized broadly into strategy, pharma, market research, and advanced analytics. We only work in life sciences. My background was in general consulting, generalist consulting, but I think there's a point in career where you can either continue on the generalist path or start to explore a vertical in some depth. This is as interesting a vertical as I think is out there right now from a consulting standpoint. I mean, the dimensions, the complexity of healthcare, seen throughout the political debate recently are all over the place. So it's one where you have to be extremely vigilant about what's going on in the market. And that's where I think the index will be helpful for us and our clients, we hope.
And is that who you have designed the index for? Is it investors or is it biotech CEOs?
I think we would, as a general rule, default to our clients. I mean, we're in a knowledge-based business and we want to transport that knowledge to our clients. Part of it, though, is internal. We have to be good at this. And we've not worked on all these launches, but we've worked on a number of them. And it's critical for us to understand, as I said, why certain things do well and why certain things don't.
So who are your clients?
They're a mix of large biopharma all the way down to startups. We don't work with everybody. Right now, last time I looked, it was 17 of the top 25. We occasionally have the expected conflict of interest, so we can't work with everybody. We tend to work with clients who are commercializing their products, so ones that are about midway through the development process and are starting to think about commercialization. Those are ideal candidates for us because we have a lot of firepower there, a lot of experience. I would say we're full spectrum.
Will you talk a little bit about the relationship between drug prices and the FDA granting market exclusivity to drugs?
Yeah, that's a big topic.
Yeah.
As I mentioned, a lot of the drugs, both in 2013 and more recently, are in the specialty category. They're biologics. They're expressed in the rare disease categories, the orphan categories. These bring exclusivity. They're an advantage to the market. And it's important to make the distinction, too, here between market exclusivity and patent exclusivity, which are two different things.
So good point, yeah.
You can end up in situations where a drug is reaching the end of its life from an approval exclusivity standpoint, but continues on from an exclusivity standpoint for quite a few more years. This happens all the time. The FDA grants exclusivity. Things like patents, though, are more the domain of intellectual property lawyers and patent lawyers. It's less a regulatory issue, more of almost a trademark issue. Pricing creeps in first and foremost, and especially conversation, because these drugs are, with exclusivity, means that no other competitors are present in the marketplace for a period of time, up to 7 years. That's a huge advantage competitively to have a sanctioned monopoly, if you will. And a lot of the drugs that are now in the $300,000 to $400,000 a year category fall into that spot. Sovaldi would not be one of those. It's not an orphan drug, but it has that higher price characteristic, and there will be more of them. There is speculation that some of the next generation products that are coming out of the gene editing world may have $1 million price tags attached to them, but they will be curative. And again, how do you put a price tag on a cure for hemophilia? But it is a complicated debate, and it's one that pharma, it's probably as significant an issue in life sciences right now on the client side as there is.
Yeah.
And it spikes during election years, of course.
Of course. John, tell people where they can find the drug index.
Yes, you can find it most immediately on our website, trinitypartners.com. We will be updating it. We'll probably be learning more and embellishing it and going deeper. And we're excited about sharing it with clients, with the public through you. And thank you for having us here.
You're very welcome. Thank you, John. That's John Corcoran, founder and president of Trinity Partners in Waltham.
Coming up, we'll get the take from John Spooner of Morgan Stanley on the market reaction to the presidential election. I'm Tom Maroney, along with my co-host Ann Mastu, the Bay State Business Hour on Bloomberg, 1294.5 FM, HD2.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Bay State Business Hour with Tom Maroney and Ann Mastu on Bloomberg 1200 and 94.5 FM HD2.
This is the Bloomberg Bay State Business Hour. I'm Ann Mastu in our Bloomberg 1200 studios in downtown Boston with my co-host Tom Maroney. And our guest today is John Spooner, Managing Director of Wealth Management at Morgan Stanley here in Boston. Welcome, John.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
So, John, the stock market had one of its best weeks the week after Trump was elected. Can you tell us why that is?
Yes, I think I can. Going into elections, of course, with the country rent asunder in so many ways, and both candidates so unacceptable to virtually one half of the country either way,
yep,
and unbelievably bitter. This time I voted early, and I went to City Hall 3 days before the elections. And I looked around, there were 1,000 people in line, everybody patient, everybody pleased to be there, every color of the rainbow, in every economic strata. I saw a billionaire in line talking to a young African-American woman with red dreadlocks, who must have been about 23 years old, and obviously to me, voting in her first presidential election, and said to myself, despite everything going on in America and all the hate and turmoil and lunacy, really, that this is what America is. So I actually felt incredibly positive going into the elections. And amazingly, the market rallied for 2 days strong, the 2 days before elections. Why? Because it looked at that point, Hillary wins, that probably the House stays Republican, which means there are checks and balances. Result.
That's the best scenario you want for someone in your business.
So, because Hillary, with all her warts and all, at least you knew what you were getting somewhat. So familiarity bred a little bit of optimism. And then the miracle surprise, Trump selected, and that both houses of Congress, I still say you cannot market time markets, because the 7 or 8 days a year that things explode on the upside, you have to be in there. Mm-hmm. And because I'm a contrarian, I'm always betting against the crowd. For instance, the most hated group for the last 5 years are financials. Hmm. So you don't just start to buy them today. I started buying financials several years ago. So if you're a contrarian and you think you see the future, it can take years before the world sees what you think you see. And when everybody thinks they know everything wrong about something, if anything goes right, there can be big upside.
Yeah, so you're looking at the long view.
For sure, saying. The long view. That's how you make money in real estate, okay, paintings, or stocks. The bar was set so low for both candidates, and both candidates really vilified on the other side of each of them. And when everybody thinks they know everything wrong about someone, if anything goes right, there can be a very big upside. And I relate that to the elections. And that's one takeaway we should all think about.
So you're specifically, John, he gave a pretty gracious victory speech, and then his visit with Obama was a good one. People took that, as you say, the bar was low. As long as nobody beat each other up, we were okay. Right?
Well, you know, the grasp onto straws. Oh, no kidding. He was gracious to Hillary. And, you know, let's take this as a positive.
I see.
You know, we can say anything we want to try and get elected. And then when you find yourself in this position, holy Fritos, folks, I'm actually got the job. What do I do now? And it'd be good to try. So since there's no expectations on so much of the public that nothing can go right, if anything does, one thing for small business, it's clear. I have lots of people who own small businesses. If there's relief from this unbelievable overregulation, it's good.
I know that your job as a money manager is also sort of that of a therapist. How do you talk people out of making bad decisions when they're really worried?
Well, one thing I say is I have to be an agnostic politically doing what I do. In other words, who's ever elected, I've got to have a game plan for my people's money. My job is I can't help you with your emotional life, but I will try and save you from doing something stupid to yourself, shooting yourself in the foot or other body parts because you're upset about something. It's not the end of the world. The sun will come up tomorrow. I go back to looking at the crowd at City Hall voting, and that's what gives me hope. And And I think now, what do you do with money specifically? I'd say again, you look at the obvious places that might benefit by this administration, and it is financials that have been beaten up, hated for 5 years. There could be a long way to go in that sector. I believe at some point we get inflation. You've got to go the commodity side, anything that you dig out of the ground, et cetera.
Copper's done very well.
Yeah, but things can have a lot further to go than just out of the box, and there will be setbacks. But agricultural products, again, the bar is set so low on the commodity side that there can be big upside if you look down the road.
Well, John Spooner, we want to thank you for being with us here right after the holiday. We appreciate it. I'm Tom Moroney, along with my co-host, Ann Mastu. This is Bloomberg Bay State Business Hour.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Bay State Business Hour with Tom Moroney and Ann Mastu on Bloomberg 1200 and 94.5 FM HD2.
This is the Bloomberg Bay State Business Hour. I'm Ann Mastu in our Bloomberg 1200 studios here in downtown Boston with my co-host Tom Moroney. And our guest today is Chris Anderson, president of the Mass High Tech Council. Welcome, Chris.
Good to be here.
Thanks for coming in. So tell us about the council, your membership this year, how things are going.
Things are going great. The council is comprised of CEOs, primarily of state-based technology firms, the leadership of the area's professional services firms, and presidents of universities and colleges that have a particular interest in engineering or STEM activities within their campuses.
So, Chris, let's get to this annual survey that you've put together. This is the first. Explain to us what you did and what you found.
Sure. What I'd like to do is put it in context. Mm-hmm. We have a project that is providing data for our interpretive analysis. Collecting data is really important for all of the policy advocacy that we represent. Our mission is to create the conditions for success for technology firms and associated parts of that ecosystem. And so we've created this Matters dashboard that provides a look at information from all 50 states that allow us to look at Massachusetts' relative strengths and competitive weaknesses, not only in Massachusetts, but in the context of our peer states. And we can talk about that in a second. But the data is one thing. Matching the data with perceptions from job creators really helps us drive our activity around the priorities of those who populate the economy in Massachusetts.
Yeah, and this Matters Index is really mesmerizing to use. We were just using it earlier, and it was really interesting to see how you're ranking various states on talent, tax, cost of doing business, quality of life. Tell us where you're getting the data.
Sure. So the four major categories that we've included in Matters, which stands for Massachusetts Technology and Talent Economic Reporting System, evolve around the four priorities that typically are used in site location decisions for large employers around the country. Access to talent, which is a category that we rank number one in the country in, is why we typically have so many success stories in Massachusetts, but that's balanced, as one can see when looking at our state profiles, that we have a number of risks that challenge our ability to add jobs in this economy.
So let's make sure the listener is clear on this. You've ranked Massachusetts number one in talent.
Yep.
How do they fall in tax?
So we're number 40 out of 50 in tax, 43 out of 50 in cost of doing business, and a pretty decent 14 out of 50 in quality of life.
So it's clear that that talent category is what really keeps people coming back.
Sure. And it's also a big part of the success we have in creating a fairly robust number of startups. I think we have pretty much the highest number of startups in the United States. The challenge is that they depart the state at some point. And so that's when the other categories that we're looking at that create competitive challenges for us become an area of interest, because we want to create environmental or policies that improve the environment for not only launching these startups in Massachusetts, and in today's economy, innovation is so important across the country, but also successfully growing them here, like so many other predecessors. EMC is a classic example for a success story that was started in Massachusetts, grew here, and is now a notable, or was until it was acquired by that Texas company, a notable global company.
Let's talk about your members and how engaged they are in giving feedback about all of this.
So our members recognize the importance of setting priorities that reflect the things that they think about every day.
So let's talk about the trouble spots. What did they say that was their most, the big bugaboo, if you will?
Well, the high cost in doing business, which correlates with our data, has been identified as the biggest risk to continuing to operate. And typically that doesn't mean they'll move so much as they'll add jobs in other locations around the country or around the world. So I think it's important if our goal is to expand our footprint of workers in Massachusetts, which also correlates to increased tax revenue, which is a good goal, then we've got to think about how we address that. Anybody who's driven around most parts of Massachusetts realize that transportation is an increasingly challenging task. It's particularly so for employers who are sensitive to getting their workers to and from work in a relative stress-free environment. That has really become a problem, and it's the second highest risk factor identified by our members. 55% say this is a risk. Mm-hmm. And then we get into the ability to find skilled workers and the lack of predictability in government policies that begin to round out the top four.
So now that you have this information, what is your role as the High Tech Council? Do you have a lobbying aspect? Do the people at the State House listen to this and say, okay, we're going to take some action here?
So the High Tech Council was formed almost 40 years ago to represent the interests of the technology economy at the State House and to some degree down in Washington. Because our members are the decision makers in these companies, we tend to be very focused and specific on the areas that we advocate for or against. So we are an advocacy or organization for
you
the technology.
You have people on Beacon Hill?
I'm one of the people on Beacon Hill. We have a small staff. Mark Gallagher is the other person that State House folks will recognize. The two of us represent the High Tech Council before policymakers on Beacon Hill.
We're talking about talent as number one, Massachusetts ranking number one in terms of STEM degrees. Quality of life is ranked 14. I think some people would argue that that's generous because even this year there's this plan to study daylight savings to keep people from leaving Massachusetts because they say it's too dark here in the winter. What are you hearing in terms of quality of life and the reasons graduates leave the state?
Well, we're going to be digging deeper into that, but I think the biggest risk factor for retaining folks isn't whether it gets dark early because of daylight savings or because we have too much or too little snow, if you like skiing or you don't like skiing. It really, those are environmental impacts that are obviously on the margin. But I think at the end of the day, we have a pretty decent ranking because we have a fairly young workforce. We have a pretty vibrant arts or cultural scene. Our professional sports teams have been doing pretty well lately. So we have a number of things that are working for us. And the natural beauty of being in New England is also an attractive feature. But the high cost of living, and if you're a young person who, you know, are interested in owning a car, moving about, living anywhere close to the eastern metropolitan Boston area, you realize that the cost of rent or purchasing a home is a lot higher here than in other parts of the country. If we were able to create an economic development strategy for the state that expanded the same kind of vibrant growth that we're seeing in eastern Massachusetts out around Worcester, which is not out of the realm of possibility, housing costs are lower, it's conveniently located, we could do a lot to begin easing some of the challenges that show up as risk factors for Massachusetts and become more competitive than we are now with some of our peer states.
So let's switch gears just a bit here. There is a proposal for a tax on the wealthy. Let's talk about that. What do you feel about that?
So there are a number of proposals that from time to time we feel would do a significant damage either to the brand Massachusetts is trying to develop as a pro-growth state or to the people who invest and create jobs in Massachusetts. And we've seen other states, Maryland, New Jersey, have each tried to increase taxes on a certain class of higher income taxpayers only to see two results. the revenue projections were not achieved because some of those individuals left the state. And the impact on the economy was less positive than was anticipated. People leave the state, philanthropy begins to migrate, and the tax revenue doesn't appear. So there is a proposal. It may show up in 2018 in Massachusetts on the ballot if the legislature approves it when it meets in a joint session sometime, to impose a constitutionally embedded tax on incomes that exceed $1 million. We would be the only state in the United States to have a constitutionally embedded tax on a certain class of taxpayers. My guess is that this would be one of the best economic development decisions the state of New Hampshire would benefit from.
Meaning everybody would go to New Hampshire.
Well, you'd have a number of folks who are very mobile, whether it's New Hampshire, Rhode Island, Florida. You'd see a change in behavior. Mm-hmm. But more importantly, it damages the brand for Massachusetts. It counters the notion that we're trying to be startup friendly. And oh, by the way, if this were to pass, and if you succeed, we're going to tax you more. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, it creates a blank check for the legislature, because they would become to either expect or depend on this increased source of revenue. When it doesn't materialize, the only place they have to look is to raise taxes on the rest of the tax base.
Chris, what's your sense right now in Beacon Hill? What are lawmakers saying? Does this have some support?
Well, if we look at the results of the 2016 election, it's really hard to predict what will and will not have support going forward. We'll do everything we can to do research and present information to the legislature so that we can identify unintended consequences before their next vote.
So Chris Anderson is president of the Mass High Technology Council. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you, Ann.
I'm Tom Maroney, along with my co-host, Ann Mostu. This is the Bay State Business Hour, Bloomberg 1200 and 94.5 FM HD2.